This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hugh Rimmington. Welcome to The Round Table. Let's talk today about an Australian paradox. Australians are living longer. We're better educated than ever before. We have not had a recession, at least by conventional judgment, in 27 years. On so many measures, we are living in the best of times. But millions of us are struggling with anxiety and depression. A new survey by the Royal College of GPs has revealed Australians talk to their general practitioners about mental health more than any other health issue. Are we experiencing, as some people believe, an epidemic of depression? Are we in, as some people argue, an age of anxiety? If you've got thoughts on this, chime in if you like. As we go to the round table, you can text us on 0418 226 576. Leave your name if you like, or at least your first name, and you can also tweet us at Radio National. At the round table today, we have psychiatrist Professor Michael Bagent from Flinders University. He's also a board member of Beyond Blue. Dr. Hugh McKay, veteran social scientist and prolific author. And Associate Professor Brock Bastian, social psychologist at the University of Melbourne and the author of the book, The Other Side of Happiness. Hello to all of you.
Good morning. Hello.
Now let's start. There's really three questions here, I guess. Is it a real issue? Are we more anxious and depressed than people were in earlier times? The second question, if that is true, what's causing it? And the third, I suppose the essential question, what can we do about it? Let's deal with the first question then. Is there something going on that we need to be looking at? Perhaps I can start with you, Professor Michael Bagent.
Well, it's really hard to know what is going on, whether the world has changed, making everybody more depressed and more anxious. If we look at some of the data from some of the research, which may well be discussed by one of the other speakers, over the last 15 to 20 years, the rates of stress, which may indicate mental disorders, has probably not actually gone up. We look at the data very, very rigorously. But nevertheless, there are many, many people in the community who would perhaps qualify as having a mental disorder, anxiety or a depression, suggesting it's still a big problem. Anxiety and depression causes about almost 30% of the disability in the community. So it's not a minor issue for the population.
So not a minor issue. Is it getting worse? Hugh McKay.
It's always with us, Hugh, and I think Michael has implied that in what he said. I mean, being human, we are anxious. There's a sort of existential angst because we can't answer the questions we most want to answer, like why are we here? What's it all about? What's it all mean? So we live with that and we try to deal with that in various ways at various times in our history. But I think at the moment, when you have prominent clinical psychologists and other health professionals saying, as they are now saying in the US and here and in Western Europe, that anxiety and depression, but anxiety particularly, is now the greatest looming problem with public health, that social isolation, which is so closely associated with anxiety, and we'll talk about that in a moment, no doubt, but social isolation is becoming the greatest threat to public health in Western societies. So, as Michael says, very hard to put figures on that, but certainly I bow to the professionals, the clinicians especially, who are saying, as you said in that opening quote from the College of GPs, that this is now on the minds of not everybody, but on a very large and growing minority, millions of Australians.
Okay, Dr. Brock Bastian, you've written about this in your book, The Other Side of Happiness. You're a social psychologist. Let's define our terms. Do you think we are in a situation which is worsening with time?
It seems that certainly it's been going up over time. I think it's right to say in the last sort of 15 years or so, it's plateaued somewhat. But what's interesting is it's also, as a percentage of the health burden, the impact on how people function in their lives, that's still climbing compared to other health conditions. So it seems whether or not the rates are still going up, we're not managing it as well as we're managing other sorts of things. And I think also that, you know, when you're starting to look at numbers like 1 in 5 and 1 in 4, you know, we have to start to see this as an epidemic in some sort of way. So we have to think about it differently. If you start to talk about an epidemic, you need to think about those broader factors that play into it and understand how they may contribute. Yeah.
Let's be a bit counterfactual here, or at least run against it. If it has plateaued, what are the things that are stopping it growing?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, and again, it's you know, these figures are sometimes hard to read, but I mean it may be that we've actually you know, people have become aware of it, awareness has increased, and now people are reporting it at a level perhaps where it has always been, but they are now reporting it more often or more frequently. Perhaps there's some over-reporting in there as well. It's hard to say.
Professor Bajant, do you have a view as to whether if it has plateaued, might that be the effect of more prescriptions of antidepressants?
Well, certainly, although we've seen antidepressants being prescribed more, I don't think they're the solution to all of these problems we're describing by any means. Perhaps more people are getting access to psychological interventions and they'd be very helpful for them, and that we know do help them, maybe even accessing self-help approaches. Perhaps the web has really helped people learn more about their conditions and address them themselves. I suspect we've got better access to psychological therapies too, which are very important. But it also might be that, you know, these conditions are unpleasant to experience, and in a way, having an unpleasant anxiety or depressive condition can actually lead people to act on it. You can only put up with it for so long. Some people, unfortunately, don't do anything about it, but the unpleasantness of the experience might drive more people to do something about it, perhaps, and it might be a ceiling achieved that way. I'm not sure.
Does it help that we talk about it more?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. What makes a great difference, we've found, is that when you have somebody who's famous or, you know, well-known talking about their own experiences and how they dealt with it and overcame their depression or anxiety, that makes a huge difference. One of the things that I think happens is that a lot of the time people have an anxiety disorder as opposed to feeling anxious about something, which is part of the human experience. They don't distinguish between the two experiences. They don't really identify themselves as having an illness that is treatable, or that they can change from. They think it's something to do with them being weak or a state that you can't do anything about, when in actual fact, an anxiety disorder such as social phobia or a phobia or panic disorder or post-traumatic stress or any of the other anxiety disorders, they're treatable conditions.
Now, Brock Bastian, they're suggesting that possibly the fact that we've got access to the internet gives us more ability to examine for ourselves some of the things that are going on, to become better informed. Hugh McKay, you're not overwhelmingly a fan of all the connectivity that happens through the internet. In fact, you've argued very much that it is part of what isolates us these days.
Mm. Yes, although what Brock says, of course, is absolutely right. As a source of information, where people can access information about the way they're feeling and how other people have done it or what services might be available. And while we're talking about the plateauing, we probably should mention the meditation movement, which has swept the West, courtesy of yoga and mindfulness and these other techniques, which probably are helping to control this for large numbers of people. So I think the internet plays a valuable role in giving people information and reassurance that they're not alone. Where I become concerned about it is when people start using particularly social media as a means of trying to connect. And I would argue that a sense of social connection is absolutely fundamental to our mental health, and that social fragmentation and increasing social isolation do contribute to our epidemics of anxiety and depression. But if we're using social media or the internet in general as a way of trying to establish those social connections, then I think we're in trouble. I think that the latest, particularly among young people, The latest research on heavy use of social media shows that the heaviest users are also likely to be more, feel more socially isolated, experience more loneliness and more anxiety as a result of the fact that they are exchanging data at a great rate with anyone who's out there. They're sleeping with their smartphone under the pillow, etc. But, of course, what we know about the human need to connect and to belong is that it happens face-to-face. And there's no substitute on the internet, even FaceTime and Skype and so on, no substitute on the internet for the eye contact, the skin contact, and just the complex interpersonal reaction that we have face to face. So, I mean, I think that's a very relevant point to this whole conversation here, because I think the more we substitute face to face time with screen time, the more likely we are to feel isolated, and I would argue, because of the human nature, therefore, the more likely we are to experience anxiety.
Okay, Hugh, I'll take that as a reprimand. I'm off Twitter for the rest of the day. Tracy is a GP. She's texted through to us. She says, some of the issue is the redefinition of stress or depression. I'm a GP and commonly get requests for mental health plans, which enable people to get a Medicare refund for seeing a psychologist. Commonly, she says, these are for common human non-diseases, such as sadness, grief, and even disappointment. Brock Bastian, would you say that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such an important point. And I think that, you know, the discussion of this and making it a public discussion is so important. But what's a really important part of that discussion is that many of these experiences, not all of them, there are obviously experiences that are very clinically important, but there are also experiences that are a normal part of life. And I think we've set up a range of expectations where people feel that they shouldn't have these sorts of experiences. And when they do, that there's a problem that they need to overcome, and they become averse to these negative experiences, their own sadness, anxiety. And I think that we know psychologically that sets up a real problem for people. It actually drives more of exactly the sorts of thing you're trying to avoid. You tend to become more anxious if you're worried about being anxious. You become more depressed if you feel upset about, you know, your feelings of depression. So I think that normalizing it is such an important part of this public conversation. Days like Are You Okay Day are really, I think, are fantastic, because it actually normalizes the conversation around these sorts of things, that we can talk normally around our negative experiences. They're not things that we have to get a solution for immediately, or we have to fix in order to be able to live life effectively.
I noticed in the Journal of World Psychiatry, just in February of this year, they had a paper in which they indicated that the growing economic inequality within a society is actually linked to mental health issues, including depression. Professor Bajant, have you seen this stuff? Do you see it has merit that, in fact, societal issues like how we run a national economy, how the market economy works, could actually be affecting our mental health?
Yes, I do. I do. I do think it's important. The issue really is, I suppose, envy, where there's one group of the population that have got an easier, better life compared to the other. And that can lead to an effect on the mental health of people. We know that that psychological and social stresses, enduring psychological and social stresses can actually lead to a person to developing a disorder like depression. We know that from animal research in learned helplessness setups, where you put a rat in a cage, turn the light off. It's nasty research, but turn the light off. Hopefully we don't do that anymore, but turn the light off, give electric shocks and so forth when it doesn't expect them, and it's got no way of escaping. And the rat eventually becomes fairly inert and clinically depressed, in the sense of a rat becoming depressed. And I think people can certainly, with persisting adversity and difficulty, can become demoralized, depressed, lose their appetite, lose hope, and meet the criteria that we have, which are very, very broad criteria in our diagnostic books for depression. But in actual fact, the cause and the solution is a social or economic one. And sometimes we get people in these situations seek a solution in the medical framework, when really the problems are better solved in a kind of looking at it socially. And certainly the whole thing to do with poverty and inequity is a very, very important social determinant of depression, as are life events.
So even those who are not on the bottom of the scale in an unequal society, it is proposed, can suffer mental health consequences of that. And in fact, I think one of the recommendations out of that World Psychiatry documentation was for mental health professionals to make an argument for decision makers, lawmakers, to work towards greater equality in society. Is that a bridge too far,
Michael? No, I think it's important. When we look at the factors and determinants leading to a person's mental illness, we look at biological factors. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. We look at psychological and we look at social factors, and all these things contribute to a person's overall mental health. And indeed, when you're looking at trying to help a person recover and get better, they're the factors that you actually look into and consider. It's very hard as an individual medical person or health worker, mental health worker, to do much about the broader social issues, but that's when advocacy comes into play. And one of the things that Beyond Blue always tries to do, and other strong advocates in the mental health setting, is to try and bring about some kind of change where it's possible and realistic. But certainly a lot of those things are in the hands of the politicians and other people, the bigger picture things, but they're very important to mental health.
You're listening to the...
Could I just comment on this?
Absolutely.
I think what Michael's just been saying is crucial, and it also echoes what Brock said a moment ago. I mean, part of the problem about income inequality is the problem of expectation. Yeah. In a society like Australia, where we're bragging about 26 years of uninterrupted economic growth, where all the talk is about the economy, as though our role in life is to be consumers, and everything has to be materially measured. When Brock talks about the problem of the expectation of happiness, which I think is a huge problem in the whole issue of anxiety, there's also the expectation of affluence. So we're talking as though Australia is this wonderfully affluent society. Well, it's not if you're in the bottom 20% of households struggling on an annual household income of not much more than about $30,000 or $35,000. And I think that all the talk about economics, the economy, growth, and the idea that our birthright as Australians is to be materially affluent exacerbates the problem for those who are not.
Brock Bastian, do you think we spend too much time worrying about trying to be happy?
Yeah, a couple of points there. I think we measure subjective well-being as well as more objective measures like gross domestic product, and you see these things pull apart. And I think one of the basic human tendencies is to compare ourselves to others. And so whether or not I think objectively speaking, our GDP in most countries is going up at the moment. We're better off than we used to be, but that's not really what drives our happiness all the time. It's also half of it is, well, who knows if it's half, it's probably more, is our comparison to others around us. And so we can be better off than we might have been before, but if we're comparing ourselves to people way up on the scale, that will lead us to feel as though we're worse off. There's a psychological component to that. And the other thing is, as Hugh said, there's a lot of research which shows that materialism just drives unhappiness and depression. And, if there's one value in our society which is constantly, being beaten, it's materialism. And I think we can't turn a blind eye to that. The more that we focus people on the importance of having things, buying things, working hard to get things, it just doesn't breed mental health.
Well, as the former Treasurer Joe Hockey said, if you want to buy a house in Australia, it pays to get a good, well-paying job. And so the pursuit of money to get the security that comes with a house seems to be built into it. We've got a message here on the text line. I've had 15-plus friends commit suicide, all marginalised poor, just saying, says someone who didn't leave a name on it. I wonder if another thing isn't going on, and that is a loss of faith in institutions. We've seen in recent times, look at the Royal Commission into the banks. Banks are no longer to be trusted. Churches are no longer to be trusted. Politicians, the media are no longer to be trusted. Does this play in, do you think, Hugh McKay?
Absolutely. I think we are in a very strange point in our social evolution where, as you say, whether you're talking about the federal parliament or the institution of politics in general or the churches or the banks or big business or trade unions or the mass media or professional sport, the loss of trust in institutions that we used to place some faith in, I think has been, in the short term, a dramatic contributor to a feeling of uneasiness which would feed into anxiety. And I don't want to be absurdly naive and optimistic about this, Hugh, but I think there actually is a silver lining here. I think our loss of faith in institutions is causing, and I think this is one of the really good things that's happening in Australia at the moment, causing many more people to start looking at what's happening in their own neighbourhood, what's happening in their own community, saying, well, maybe it's up to us. Maybe we've got to start figuring out what sort of society we want to live in and start making it happen where we are. I do think that the health of the nation can mainly be assessed through the health of local neighbourhoods, and local neighbourhoods have been fragmenting. Edith Cowan Research published a survey a few years ago showing a very high level of mistrust of neighbours. Now, that worries me much more than mistrust of banks or churches or politics. And I think the tide might just be starting to turn. I hear all these wonderful stories of local communities where neighbours are getting together and organising a community garden or a street party or a trampoline for the kids to share or whatever it might be. So I don't think that's long term. I think we will need institutions that have regained our trust. But in the immediate short term, I think many people do feel, well, perhaps it is up to us, and that might be a good thing. If we don't look to our leaders for moral guidance or for vision about the kind of society we might become, then where will we look? And the answer might be just to each other.
Michael Bajard, how do you think we can build up our own strengths against anxiety and depression?
Well, I agree with what Hugh's been saying about the importance of the community and being connected and feeling you've got shared values and you've got a shared purpose in life. And one of the tragedies about the things, the changes that you've been identifying, is that when people have a clinical depression as opposed to this sort of emotional, normal type of depression, which is, it's important to delineate between the two, people who are depressed are quite vulnerable to these sorts of changes because loss in faith, if you bank, it reinforces your view that the world's a hostile, frightening place, which is the kind of the stance that people have when they're depressed, which is abnormal for them, that they're not being able to trust the neighbours, that kind of fuels the depressive view of other people that they have and can lead them to get a lot worse than they were before. But I certainly think that the social connectedness, all those things that we mentioned before, they're absolutely vital for the mental health of the community in a broader sense.
What about severe depression, something which is beyond merely just feeling as if things are a bit against you?
Yeah, well, look, if you haven't seen somebody who's got this really, really terrible depression, then you would be shocked. There's a real sense of it being a strong biological thing. The person loses significant weight. They're a changed person from how they were before. They're often agitated. If you don't help them, they'll lie there and do nothing, or they'll become so agitated they'll try and end their life. And it's got a high mortality associated with it. This is a really, really serious condition and warrants treatment. It's a lot different to the type of depressive symptoms that you might get in response to events that have affected you. And this is one of the problems that we have with this whole field of depression, particularly depression, is that the diagnostic category is so broad. It collects up people who are living in adverse life circumstances, as well as people who have that kind of really severe melancholic kind of endogenous type of depression that is absolutely visibly life-threatening, and lumps it all together. And they've all got different causes and different solutions, and that's where the difficulty is. But the social issues of connectedness and so forth are vital in terms of prevention and helping people to recover.
So for severe depression, start with your GP, I guess.
Absolutely, yes. And we certainly don't want to medicalise mental illness, which was the comment that was being made by your GP earlier on. It's very important. Depression is as a mood symptom, or as a symptom, is part of life, or an emotion is part of life. It brings about a lot of important things. Creativity leads people to change their circumstances and situation. Anxiety also has an important role in protecting us and driving our performance. But it can reach a point where it is severe and disabling and life-threatening. And certainly then you need to go to see your doctor initially. A lot of these things can actually have medical causes as well. And the doctor can actually, you know, take a look at you and assess you and work out whether there's medical cause or what would be the best approach to help you. So, yeah, the severe depression can be life-threatening. A lot of the anxiety disorders warrant treatment, and people can get a lot better from what they're at, from how they are.
An encouraging, message for people who don't have life-threatening depression, who have a more common or garden variety version of depression or anxiety. Brock Bastian, you've suggested some ways to build resilience. Over to you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a range of things that we can offer. I mean, I think again, how you frame these things, how you think about them, really determines how you respond to them. And these experiences are not only an important part of life; they're a really valuable part of life. Sometimes, you know, it's these sorts of experiences which, as you said, they can help us to build resilience. We need to often experience things in life in order to know how to respond to them effectively. If we don't have any of these experiences, we see that people tend to be less resilient rather than more. I think, you know, these are also experiences. We often feel that we need to connect with people around positive things, around happy things, but actually it's sometimes sharing our sadnesses, our difficulties in life, which are actually the things which grow our bonds the strongest. And we might feel that we don't want to talk to other people because we'd burden them. But, you know, if we flip that story around, we often feel, you know, privileged to be able to have somebody who would share with us those sorts of experiences. And they are things which can bring us together. So there are a range of ways in which engaging, I suppose, in a less evaluative way, in a more open and accepting way with some of these experiences in life. Again, the normal ones, not the clinically relevant ones, which can actually turn them into something which is quite productive and can actually, it's part of what makes us happy is to have these experiences in life, in fact, and recognising that helps us to respond better to them.
All right. Very quickly, one word sort of answers, I suppose. Michael Bagent, if there's a single thing out there for someone who's struggling right now listening to this, what would you say?
Go on to the Beyond Blue website and work out what's going on with you.
Hugh McKay.
Go next door, see if the neighbour needs a hand with a bit of mowing or shopping. The real message is for people who are not anxious and not depressed to look out for those who are, to make sure we're in touch with the people in our street or our apartment block who might be at risk of social isolation and therefore of heightened anxiety.
Brock Bastian.
Yeah, I mean, get information and seek out support as you need it, but also don't worry so much about it. It is a part of life, so I think we can expect some of those feelings sometimes.
Psychiatry Professor Michael Bagent, Hugh McKay, Dr. Brock Bastian, thank you all for your time today. And if you would like to talk to someone after issues that might have been raised by this discussion, Lifeline's number is 131114, and Beyond Blue, as you've heard, 1300 224 636. Thank you to all of our guests. And thanks also to our producers here at RN, Chris Bullock and Sky Doherty, and engineer Jen Parsonage. That's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. I'm Hugh Remington. Until next week.